Good afternoon. It's Chickie Fitzgerald and another glorious day in Tampa, Florida. We are getting to the end of the school year. I cannot believe it. And I've got a senior graduating from high school, and senioritis has set in. We had a skip out day today and senior prom tonight, so a good time is had by all. I am really, really excited about our topic today because I am in the travel industry, as most of you know, and the whole sharing economy has absolutely invaded my industry. And so we're going to be talking about sharing, and we're going to be talking about a book called Shareology, How Sharing is Powering the Human Economy. And our guest today is author Brian Kramer. You may have heard his TED Talk, and Brian is a public speaker, and he's got an agency that he'll tell you about as we begin talking. Brian, welcome.
Hey, thank you so much. And I completely understand the whole senioritis thing. I've got one of those myself.
Yeah, nobody told me the rules, and I went to wake her up this morning, and she's like, Mom, I get to sleep in today. And it's like, oh, well, that wasn't published in the schedule. Is yours a boy or a girl?
It's a girl. It's a girl.
Ah, okay. So I'm sure you have some of the same things. Well, terrific. Well, Brian, why don't you give our listeners a little bit of your background, just the thumbnail, so that they can get a perspective of seeing what you did before you became an author, and tell us a little bit about your current business.
Sure, sure. My background is in kind of the triad of marketing as they've come together, and my degree is actually in public relations. My passion is in digital marketing. Actually, my career has been in digital marketing up until social media. And then my overarching kind of, thing that brought it together was just marketing itself. And so I've worked my way through agencies my whole life, basically helping them in through the .com to learn how to become digital agencies. And so my whole job was to take traditional agencies and help build them into digital firms. And so that led me up to a consulting firm that I helped to start with two other people. And we sold it at about 75 people at the height. And then I turned around and with my then girlfriend, now wife of 15 years, we started a business called Pure Matter 15 years ago. And it's a marketing agency, a social marketing agency, a content social marketing agency, I should say, that helps enterprise companies like Cisco and MasterCard and so on to help with their content and social marketing. So in between all that, a few years back, I hit a point in my life where I was trying to figure out what I wanted to do with me and for myself and what direction I was going to head, not only with the agency, but also my own career. And so I started to get really passionate about social and content marketing. And this was at a time when everything was just kind of getting started. And I looked at what was possible, and I started to try and figure it out. And the more I tried to figure it out, the more I realized that I was starting to connect with people around the world, and content was really resonating with people, and my blog was starting to resonate, and I was really becoming quite passionate about it, because it was like, again, that intersection between media, PR, digital, everything that we've done is all wrapped up into one. And I just got so excited about that. So I took it and ran with it. And in my first book, Human to Human, there's no B2B or B2C, it's HH, Human to Human.
Right. And I was just going to mention that. I absolutely love that, because I'm a technologist and an entrepreneur, and that's really my day job. The radio show and consulting, is just kind of what I do to keep the lights on. And I have a product that we actually sell B2B, but the product is a consumer product. And so I am going to begin using the H2H, because I think that that makes so much more sense.
Oh, that's great. That's great. Yeah, it's kind of interesting because things have changed, right? there is no more B2B because we have the ability to talk directly with the customer. We can sell directly to the customer. There is the ability for anyone in any company to talk with the customer, from engineering to product design to HR, you name it, anyone has access to the customer, where before that wasn't the case. So whether you're in a big company or a small company, it really makes sense now in terms of communication how that happens. Now, the one thing I'm not trying to say is that business has changed. There is still a dynamic difference between B2B companies and B2C companies in that there's a bit of a different process change between the two internally. But what I'm talking about more is the communication habits and the styles there.
Absolutely, absolutely. So, Brian, did you always want to write a book, or, you know, was this something that came out of your agency work and people wanting for you to codify, you know, what you had already been using in your practice?
Yeah, that's a great question. Yes, I have always wanted to write a book, but this book actually hit me over the head. I didn't plan on writing it. It was like this surprise baby that you just don't even know where it came from. Actually, Shareology, the book that I wrote, the second book, I was already working on that, and that was my first book. Would have been my first book if HDH didn't become the surprise baby it did. What happened is I was standing on stage at giving a keynote at Bloomberg West, and one of the slides in the middle was the exact title as you know it for HDH. And it was up on the screen, and I went to the next screen, and somebody said, hey, can you go back? We want to take a picture of it. I did, and half the audience took a picture of it and started tweeting it. Over the next 48 hours, it got over 80 million impressions. It had been translated over the next 2 weeks into over 15 languages that we could count, and it had well over 2,000 bloggers that had blogged about it. So I was getting a lot of different interest in what that meant. Not just the meme itself, but how does this work into everything that we're doing? And so I quickly, actually, thank God I've been blogging about it. So I highly recommend to any of your entrepreneurs that are listening, if you're thinking about writing a book, start blogging now. That saved me, because then once I started to see that this was relevant and that people needed more information about it, I quickly turned to all of my blogs and I pulled it together and wrote a book very quickly because of my blogs in 4 days, self-published it, got it out, and ended up becoming a bestseller on Amazon. I think we've sold about 15,000 books because of it. So that was not something that I planned on doing. It was not something that I didn't, you know, that I thought would come along, but it was very well welcomed once it came, because it had been something that I've been talking about for well over 10 years, and now all of a sudden it became more relevant because of where we're at in the economy of trying to automate everything.
Right, right. So I am quite certain that there's a backstory behind Shareology. So why don't you give us a glimpse into that?
Yeah, so Shareology is something that I worked on for over, like I said, probably about 3 years before HDH was started. I set Shareology down to work on HDH, and then that turned into speaking and other things. So I really didn't work on it up until a year ago. So it launched last July. I started working on it a year before that, or picked it back up again and started working on it. So the idea behind Shareology was really kind of where my mindset was, and how people, how, when, where, what, and why people and brands share. And what I basically want to do is take the whole sharing philosophy, not just sharing on social media, but sharing in general, offline and online, the sharing economy, the collaborative economy, whatever you want to call it, but how people are sharing today versus how they shared before and where it's heading. So I wanted to take that and put a kind of a formula to it so I could understand how people needed to share in order to be successful. A lot of people ask, how do I make something go viral, which is darn near impossible to come up with a formula for, but I wanted to come as close as I could to a methodology or a model for doing that. And so I basically went out and I spent over a year interviewing over 250 quality, credible people, from psychology and psychiatrists and anthropologists, social anthropologists, to PhDs and executives and CEOs of major companies, and identified basically one major thing, and that's that that everybody shares because they want to connect. People want to connect with other people. That's why you share. Now there's different emotions and meanings behind their sharing, but which I walk through in the book. But the idea behind it is how we connect and who we connect with. So oftentimes we're not as strategic about it. And so I really wanted to put some methodology behind it. And that's what the book's about.
Very, very interesting. So, you know, you begin talking about the importance of sharing. And I have to admit that, you know, I'm very, very active on social media. And I wonder how we did it before social media, how we shared our lives. I almost can't remember. And if this was, you know, if this intense desire to share, share experiences, share brands, you know, et cetera, if that was always in us, then we must have been very, very frustrated before social media.
Yeah, it's true. We tend to forget I couldn't agree more. We forget what it was like. You know, back when even we didn't have websites. What did we do to sell our businesses? I remember that time as well. And you know, all these things change over time, and they change so fast. And here's the thing: like things are changing so fast, so much even faster. They're compounding faster. And as these things change, we're getting you know, behind in certain technologies like or sharing platforms like, you know, Snapchat is the newest, latest, greatest. And so what does that mean to our business? And there's already 7 to 10 other major sharing platforms. So now what do I do and how do I put that in the mix and who's the right audience for that? And then live video comes out and, you know, it's one of the coolest things I've seen personally in the last few years on how you can get, you know, get in front of people. But again, how do you use it? Who is your art audience and what's going to work for things like Facebook Live and Periscope and all these other things. So, you know, again, like these things just came up like just within the last six to 12 months. Can you imagine where we're going to be with virtual reality and virtual, you know, technologies just within the next 6 to 12 months? And then
well,
you
I'm hoping
sharing
we can
into
do
that.
That beam me up, Scotty thing, because I'll tell you what, I spend way too much time in the car.
Yeah, it'll certainly make traveling easier. We're going to be able to, you know, see each other a little bit easier without having the next best thing to teleportation.
Right. So you talk about the secret sauce for brands, and you have developed something that you call the shareability quotient. Can you share a little bit about that with us?
Yeah, sure. So what I wanted to make sure is that people understood what to share, because a lot of times the sharing that you do, if you were to post something about The Economist for the next 5 days, for example, and you did that for the next 5 days, people would start to think and align their thoughts about you, basically branding you as someone who was into The Economist, and maybe it was something specific within The Economist, like maybe it's financial or something like that. The more you share about that and the more often you share about it, the more your brand starts to change in terms of other people's perceptions. What that means is that what you share, you are what you share. And so so the idea is that you can change the course of perception. And I know there's a good and a bad here. You can use it for evil, and I hope people don't, but using it for good
right.
is the right thing to do. And if you really want perceptions around something because you're not getting it the way that you anticipated or wanted, and this applies to both people and brands, but if you apply the methodology of how to build the right perception around you, let's say you want to be a speaker one day, well, you know, the more you share about speaking, the more people are going to start to know that that's what you want. But otherwise, it becomes a mind-reading, you know, process, and you don't
right,
want people
right.
to mind-read. You want them to know exactly what it is you do and how you do it. And the other thing that I'd say is that you don't want to do it all the time, because we're three-dimensional humans, right? People see us as if you share it all the time, as boring and flat. What you really want to do is you want to apply, you know, I outlined this in the book as well, this idea of if anybody out there is familiar with photography and how photographers take pictures, it's done in thirds. So it's called the rule of thirds. And if you take a picture so that's offset to the left or offset to the right, it becomes a much more interesting picture. If you take the picture dead center every single time, it becomes uninteresting and boring. So the same thing applies to sharing. If you share in thirds, in the rule of thirds, you're a much more three-dimensional, interesting human being. So take take for example highlighting others as a third of the time that you share. Take for example a third about maybe tips, tricks, news, ideas, thoughts, brainstorms, humor. That could help for a third of the time. And then maybe the other third of the time is then about you and your speaking, because that's what you want people to know. Now you've given people a little bit more well-rounded approaches to who you are, and they're going to be able to identify with you more, so that when it does come time for speaking, they also know that's a part of you.
Interesting. You know, as I take a look at the shareability quotient, which is relating the likelihood of a share and the perceived reputation of the content or the source, it strikes me that the first thing that you were talking about, which is the things that I share, essentially come back on me and impact my reputation. So if I spend all of my time talking about my kids online, then, people are only going to think about me as a mom. And when a consulting engagement call comes up, they're not going to think, need to call Chickie, right? And that kind of sharing that we get in the habit of doing because it's easy and it's fun and we like to talk about our kids is effortless. And this kind of sharing that you're talking about, where brands need to think about how things are going to be shared or if they're going to be shared or how I can ensure the likelihood of that share, actually is very, very thoughtful and requires that you actually think things through. And again, if you're sharing content versus creating content, making sure that you understand the reputation of the source. And we see, particularly during this political season, we see so much that is shared that was posted, right? And even the validity of some of the major news networks are now being called into question because there really isn't a foundation for truth anymore. And so I'm really wanting to dig into the shareability quotient because, as we talk about what do you share as a brand, it is so important to create, valid content versus just sharing things that look interesting.
Yeah, and that's part of, and I talk about that too, the ability to curate content is a skill. And what content you share is certainly going to say something about you. So like I said before, what you share is how people are going to interpret you. And that doesn't mean that you had to write it. If you share content that somebody else has written, it's going to be still aligned with your brand, whether, again, it's your brand or your company or your personal brand. So
a great example of that is this radio show, because I'm not curating the content, because this is all about you and your book and you as an author and you as a speaker. But the fact that I only interview business authors, right, and that I'm not interspersing that with, somebody who writes a historical romance novel, right, people do know what to expect. So I'm sorry I interrupted. Go ahead with your thoughts.
Oh, it's all right. Interrupted. No, absolutely. No problem.
yeah, it's my show. I get to do that, right?
Yeah. Anytime you want. I agree. And I would say that you've curated authors. So you've put together a group of people that are going to help, help you share out something that aligns with your brand. And that helps you and it helps me. And it's very, very it's a very giving mutual network. And my friend, Kari Anderson, who has written several books, one of them called Mutuality, would say that mutuality is the basis for, all sharing, that when you are in a mutuality mindset between two people and can share things out about each other, then you're going to see greater results. And it also boils down to that idea of giving long before you take something from someone. And that, I think, is the shift between social media and what we experienced before, because now if you were to go ask somebody to share something for you, it'd be asking them to do something for a favor, where now if somebody actually sees something about you that that really resonates, that, you know, it aligns with their brand or that aligns with their personal thinking, and they go and share it, then it's just being helpful. And so I really believe in this giving before you get, long before you ask, mindset, and doing things like podcasts and doing things like writing blogs and building content that gives back to other people and talks about their efforts and helps to highlight their, you know, successes. That's the kind of thing that's going to help come back in spades to help you.
Right, and understanding how all of this fits together and really the economic impact, because as we're talking to business leaders, and whether it is entrepreneurs who are trying to launch a new business or you know, folks who are trying to build large businesses and take their businesses to the next level, at the end of the day, we are talking about sharing in the human economy and the human-to-human impact, really, of everything that we do. And so I'd like for you to touch on what it means to take our sharing to the next level. And because social and social media is such a huge part of what we're doing, you talk in Chapter 2 really about integrating social into what we're doing. And you've got a great quote, and I didn't realize that Courtney was your wife, but you've got a great quote from her in here about, you know, really thinking things through seriously, right? And not just saying, oh, yeah, you know, we thought that through, but really getting serious about what you're doing.
Yeah, that's not a hard acronym to forget once you think about think it through seriously either. So one of the ideas behind, you know, where we're at and how to integrate all these things that we're doing is to think about where we, well, first of all, let's take a step back. Let's think about where we were when direct mail was a thing. Direct mail, how many times did we get things in the mail that didn't make sense? It was like a spammed inbox, if you will, and
right.
We got so many letters and so much stuff that it was overloaded and overwhelming. And I think we're back to that again, but it's just in a digital nature. And now the fact is that we don't receive mail anymore, right? We don't have if I go to my actual mailbox, it's not even a tenth of what it was at that one point in time when we had all that mail coming to us. So now you look at your inbox, your spam box or your inbox, and you look at your Twitter account, you look at your Facebook account, you look at your Instagram account, you add up all these different mini inboxes and you think, well, you know, where do I start and how many people are trying to get my attention? And in this world today, we've really put ourselves into a little bit of a pickle, because now there's so much noise. It's so much bigger than it ever was in our actual mailbox. We have to think, well, where are we going to turn to get that information? Well, that becomes the biggest challenge, is how do you cut through the clutter of the noise that is today? Right. And to do that, you really have to think, I think, in terms of being more human, because I think that things are becoming more automated and we're turning off, whether it's consciously or subconsciously, we're turning off the idea of whatever it is that's being sent to us. So, you know, if I see an email that comes through that has my name spelled wrong, or that it says "Dear Sir," you know, it looks like it's been, you know, robotically put together and blasted out to a billion people, then I immediately trash it before ever giving it a chance. The more human it is, the more I'm likely to read from subject line to opening line to, you know, maybe the first five sentences. And that's very, very rare that I'll do that. And that's because it's very, very rare to cut through the clutter using a human response. So I would say go back to the beginning and think about things that you could do that will help to really resonate online. Like, for instance, on Twitter, I have over 160,000 people on Twitter, and I rarely get somebody who just says, "Hey, how's your day going?" I mean, that kind of response is so, or that kind of reply is so easy to do from a brand too, than just spouting off content and repeating, you know, things that other people have said. Actually reach out to people and say something. if you did that, like for instance, every Saturday, I have a fairly large email list, and I get a lot of replies from people around the world asking me questions. So every Saturday, I will go on a walk for about an hour and a half to 2 hours, and I literally reply back in video. I will take their question, and I'll reply back, and I'll answer it and say, hey, Christy, thanks so much for reaching out. What I think you should do is, and then I'll, for about a minute, I'll answer the question, and then I attach it to the email and reply. Man, the response I get from that is so awesome every single time, and I make friends all over the world by actually connecting in a more human way than just replying back and saying, hey, here's what I think you should do. So my point is, be more human in your communication. If you do that, you're going to stand out.
Well, and I love the formula that you have put together here of the four rules of social context, and this is what you were just going through with us. But the first one, again, is think it through, skip to the last page first, slow down. That's a big one. Reading things actually before you hit enter is something I have to remind myself to do. And get out of your head, which is what you were talking about of, you know, this old habit of thinking that everybody knows what's actually rattling around in your brain, which just is not always the case. So let's move on a little bit to talk a little bit more about context. Because the funny thing about social is that my context isn't necessarily apparent to you, right? When I am writing something and it's popped into my head, people need to understand that context. So, and you talk here, I love one of your subchapters of contextual shape-shifting.
Yeah, that's it. And that goes in line with the idea behind virtual reality. Contextual shape-shifting is a thing where you can sit on two different seats from around the world or two different desks, and you can if you remember those little pins and needles at the science and exploration museums where you would put your hand in it and the needles would push out on the other end and it looked like your hand. It's the same theory where you can actually take this material as kind of like the needles where you're shaping something in front of you. And while you're doing that same material is sitting on that person's desk around the world, and they can see you shaping it. And then they can actually help too. They can actually push things, and it'll make those changes to the other person's form around the world. And so this is actual physical shape shifting. There's virtual shape shifting where you're sharing, ideas and shapes and shifting and building within worlds, within virtual worlds. Like architects are going to have a field day with this. Minecraft, if anybody's kids out there play Minecraft, you know that there's now virtual reality glasses that go with that Microsoft built. And kids will now be able to, within the next year, put glasses on and be able to build the world inside of Minecraft with their actual hands by standing, seeing, viewing, and building this world, which shows so much more potential for the business world than ever before to be able to create new things physically and have people be a part of it and so on and so forth. So that's really what shape-shifting is about. It's about creating things in collaboration in a world that's much, much different than, talking over the phone or on a podcast.
Got it. So as we move through the book, you then start talking again about this whole human-to-human concept. And why don't you give us just a little thumbnail, since you actually got hijacked by the human-to-human concept as you were writing this book. So talk to us a little bit about the human business movement and how you become a leader in this human economy that we were just talking about.
I think businesses right now, I've talked about this a little bit before, where businesses are afraid to put their people out front. They're afraid to build evangelist type examples of people, or building an evangelist team of people that are can stand out. And the reason that I start with that is because most companies, as I see it, are still thinking back to the day when it was brand first, and right now I think it's people first. I think that people have a much stronger ability to influence others over the purchase of a sale than brands do. I think if I were to walk into a biking store and ask somebody to help me purchase a bike, they'd sell me one of the bikes that they have organized, because that's the brands that they represent. Where if I went to, my friend Dave, and I asked him which bike he thought would be best for me, he'll say, well, I tried 5 different bikes. He's a total biking enthusiast. And he said, honestly, based upon you and what I know already and everything that I've tried and the races I've done and the price point I think you're at, this bike really helped me out. And I think this one over here can help you. Now I'm going to trust Dave on that more than I'm going to trust the store, because he knows me. And I trust him more than I trust the store. It's just a matter of fact. And so now I'm going to go back into the store and say, this is the bike I want. I'm going to try it out. I'm probably going to end up liking it and buying it. And now Dave is not going to get any kind of commission from that. He's just very excited about the fact that he just helped a friend. Now, I think the future of the human economy is actually realizing the people within the organization that can already do that, that can already be trusted advisors to people outside the company, and they become your salespeople simply because that's what they influence. They are influencers because they're passionate about that topic, and you align them with it, and you help them talk to people outside your company on that thing. And when they do that, you're going to be able to see a much larger scaled sales force, because they're literally just helping, they're not selling. And so I think employee advocacy, that's why employee advocacy has become so huge, because again, when you see a tweet about somebody saying something about their company, you think much better things than when the company says something about themselves. So that is a huge part of it, is putting your people out first.
Well, and you also talk about the giving ratio and how someone was asking me earlier this week what I thought about these campaigns where people, put out a little bit of free content and then a little bit more and a little bit more. And, I, for one, don't happen to like that approach. And it's because I know what they're up to, right? And that at the end of the day, they're going to ask me to buy something. And you talk about how people reach out to you and ask you to do something, and you may not even remember who they are or the context of how you met them, right? And so having a more giving, and I don't even know how to put this, so maybe I should just let you talk about the giving ratio in this whole equation.
So my giving ratio is different than others. I'm definitely interested in what you just said, because I know, there is a trust factor in the the funnel of giving, if you will. I just made that up. But I think that
sounds like a new book.
I think that different people respond in different ways, and you have to go with the majority. That's one side of it. The other side is that bigger companies need to personalize more. There are times when they just send the same thing out to everybody, and it's not organized well for everyone to be receiving the thing that matters to them most. So there's this whole idea of personalization as part of your giving tree. And then there's this other concept of giving long before you get, or long before you ask. And I am a proponent of that. And it worked out. I think for me, it proved itself. I mean, I'd never asked my community for, I don't think, anything or any help along the way for the last 3 years, as I started to build now over 300,000 followers across all my social media platforms and databases. And then when I went to launch Shareology, it was the first time I actually asked for something. I said, hey, I could really use some help selling this or buying my book, and here's right. what it's about. And I ended up being just completely overtaken with the amount of support, with almost 30,000 books sold. And it just goes to show that I think I can't prove this because I can't go back in time, but I really believe that if I just asked everybody to share my book, 2 years ago, before I gave so much content and things away, that it just wouldn't have resulted in the same outcome. And so I think that there is a strong methodology, there are strong thinking for giving long before you ask. I don't necessarily even know what I'm going to ask for in the future. I don't even know if I'm ever really going to. But right. Every once in a while, you do need help, and it's okay to ask for help. I think that a lot of companies ask for help too soon, like right away. And I think it's like dating. Like you don't ever want to do too much. There's a process to it first, and there's the dance, and there's all these things that help to build relationships over time before you ever, really qualify the relationship. So I think that is a huge part of it, and you really do have to give long before you ask.
I'm just laughing because my daughter, who is the senior with serious senioritis, was asking me this morning. She's got a young girls conference that she has gone to for years, and she wants to go back and be a coach this summer. And, it's a great cause, building lifelong self-esteem in teen girls. And, I was encouraging her to go, but in the past I've had to arrange, someone to pick her up at the Phoenix airport and drive her up to the place where this camp is being held. And she was asking me, if I had any friends who would feel okay letting her drive their car, because obviously she's still too young to rent a car, even though she can fly by herself. And so this whole issue of asking people for something before you have established that trust and that relationship, it just strikes me that it's like somebody asking, can my 18-year-old borrow your car for a week?
Right.
Because that's what we're doing. And I get emails every day with people asking me, to buy something or to promote something for them. And LinkedIn and platforms like that have just, opened the door for that. And I don't like saying no to people. So, I've had, and I certainly don't like ignoring them, which, with the volume that you tend to get, it just asks for that. But, the bottom line here, and it's the formula that you mentioned in this chapter, and I want to talk about this just before we move on to the second part of the book, which is really the ology side of Shareology. And that formula that you mentioned at the end is quantity plus quality times consistency equals success. And, that assumes that you've also woven in that relevance of making sure that what you're asking people for or what you're offering them in the way of free content is actually relevant to them.
Right. Yeah, that's one of my favorite parts of the book. I know that, there's a lot of content out there, and the best approach is to make it as relevant as possible and stay relevant for your audience. And I'm a big believer in the ask method. Ryan Levesque wrote a great book called The Ask. And if you read it, you'll definitely start to understand the four different ways that you can ask people something that will get you farther to the truth about what it is that you need to share or what you need to sell. And so I'm a huge believer in the ask method, and I think that content is the same thing. So if you want to ask people how what kind of content is working, after you've written something, how did that resonate? What did you think about that? I mean, the whole idea here is to keep things relevant, but the only way you know if it's relevant is if people tell you. There's two primary things that go into understanding that. One is the analytics. Did people come and visit your page? Two, what did they take away from it? The only way you can understand that human behavior is by asking. So, putting things like a little exit interview or actually email sign up or gated content that you can then reach out and ask them, what do you think and what do you want to see and how can I help you? Again, it's all about this helping, like help me help you. You're going to get so much feedback, and then your content is going to get better. It's not this throwing mud against the wall, writing stuff and seeing if they come. It's asking people, hey, what do you want to read? And I will write that.
Right, right. So as we move into part two of the book, and you have a kind of a fun disclaimer at the beginning that, you know, talks about this part of the book being really in the weeds because you did all of this research, and now you're distilling all of that down. So talk to us a little bit about the science of this and what you learned, you know, as a part of the interviewing process. What were some of the consistencies of what you heard?
Of the interviewing process for everybody that I interviewed for the book?
Yes.
Yeah, so everyone had that I interviewed, you know, was coming at it from a little bit of a different direction. Some people worked for companies, some were executives, some were entrepreneurs, and some were, you know, solopreneurs in private practices or whatnot. And it was very interesting to see the answers that came through. There was personal opinions, and then there were people that were quoting research. For me, the research is what stood out the most because that's what people want. They want facts and figures and ideas that actually worked before. One of my favorite interviews was probably with Ben and Jerry's because they're very human. They're a very human company, but they also are able to quantify what they do. And see how it can work for their brand and you know, what they stand for. Like, for instance, they're really all about community, and they're really about the communities that help to support to build the ice cream. And so, you know, they have dairy farmers that are building, you know, the ingredients that help to make the brand thrive. And so they went and they like to go back and actually help the dairy farmers that are helping them. And so they went to the different communities of the little micro communities that were helping to support the products or the ingredients of the ice cream. And they did these little micro campaigns around the community, and they had people submit photographs on Instagram with a certain hashtag, so they collected, and then they took I think it was a very obscure or abstract campaign around what they thought you know, would make their community thrive, and take a picture of that. And so they got all these pictures of what makes their community thrive. And then they took that picture and the winning picture, they had a judging panel, and they actually went out and said, congratulations, your photo won. And then they would take that picture and they would make a campaign around it and target it back to the community, brought to you by Ben and Jerry's. And so they would, they actually put it up on billboards around that town. They put it in the Facebook and targeted, you know, on their Facebook pages saying, congratulations to this community. Here's what makes this community thrive. And it did a really cool thing. It had the community, you know, it gave back to the community. It got them really excited about what makes their community thrive and come together. At the same time, it also it connected them with this brand that was already being supported. The ingredients that were being built inside of that community were being built or were being produced to support Ben and Jerry. So it was this really neat little idea of how to use social media and the idea of giving back in a very human way, and while still somewhat being a part of or attaching their brand onto it without being too obtrusive about it. And they did that in micro communities all over the country, and it was very successful. They saw such a great uptick in sharing about their communities and Ben and Jerry's, and they could quantify that.
Well, I love this whole section of the book because there are so many stories and so much practical advice that comes out of that. And, you know, we just don't have time, unfortunately, to go through this in the level of depth. You know, it's probably enough for a whole nother interview, and I want to be mindful of your time. So in the last couple of minutes that we have, can you just give us a thumbnail about what's next in sharing? You know, what is the future of sharing?
Yeah, part of it I can tell you, and the other part, if I knew that, I'd probably be wealthier than I am right now. But my idea of what I think is coming is that a lot of the social networks are going to start to figure out who they are They've been maturing and growing up, and they haven't quite known what they are or who they are. And I think that's starting to happen. I think Facebook obviously knows maybe the most, but you got some danglers out there like Twitter and even Instagram's coming along, but Snapchat's new on the scene, and a lot of people are new on the scene, and they're trying to figure out who they are what they want to be when they grow up. I think within the next few years, they're going to start to figure that out, and there'll be more than just new companies on the scene. They'll be very helpful and analytical, so that we have a much better use for them. Using these different technologies is never easy. So I think while social sharing has been around, or social media or content has been around for years now, we can say it's been around for almost a decade. But there's still so many companies that don't use it quite to the ability or the level that they could or should. That still is going to be important over the next few years. So I would say that doing some of these things that we even talk about on this podcast are going to be very important for them to understand in the next few years. And then the other part is just to embrace new things as they come out. I think we're all becoming better early adopters. 10 years ago, again, we were like just a complete, like there was a lack of understanding as to what all this stuff meant. And now we have a much, much better picture, and we understand at least that it can be helpful in certain areas of your business. And so now as new things roll out, I think we're less afraid to try them, because we've seen that by not trying them as they come out, we lose out. And I'm not saying that you have to use it entirely for your business, but what I am saying is that you should try it, try everything just to test it, just to see, just dip your toe in the water and see how it works. And that doesn't mean that you have to incorporate it into your marketing plan for the next 5 years, but not trying it today means that you may be left behind for what could have been or could have worked for your business. So I think that's another thing. And then the final thing I'll say is just, that virtual reality and augmented reality are things of the future and of the near future. The glasses are out now, and they're going to need some refining, but eventually we're going to be able to do some things in business and in life that we haven't been able to do before. And that's going to change the way that we think, feel, and act together as well.
Right, right. Well, Brian, this has been so interesting. And again, for those of you who have been listening, we have been talking to Brian Kramer about his book, Shareology. And Brian, just quickly, can you tell folks how they can contact you if they would like for you to speak at their event, or if they'd like to learn more about Pure Matter?
Yeah, easy. So go to puremattr.com, puremattr.com, and that's where you can find out more about my agency. So if you're looking for social or content, that's where we do that. And then on the Brian Kramer side, for my books and speaking, and I have a podcast and content and all kinds of stuff, you can go to briankramer.com, and that's Brian with a Y and Kramer with a K.
All right, perfect. Well, Brian, I know you need to run, so I just want to thank you again for taking time to speak with us today.
Oh, thank you so much. I really appreciate it and enjoyed it.
Take care.
Okay, bye-bye.